Okay, and in early 67, you record a 45. Do you recall the date on that?
Our records show that it was February 26th, 1967, which was a Sunday. We recorded it, Tim Kerr at Dove Studios.
Tim was the producer?
That's correct.
And that's Dove in Bloomington?
Correct.
And whose idea was it to come up with the song, I've Got Nowhere to Run, and who was the writer?
His name is Marc Leboutier, and he was another classmate. That's all we've talked about so far, I think, is high school classmates, almost, from Stillwater. And he was a big fan of ours and had picked up guitar about the same time that we had picked it up. Joined the Coast Guard rather than being sent over to Vietnam, but would come back on weekends since he was stationed in Green Bay, and would spend time with us, go to gigs, and during his Coast Guard duties, which I imagine were pretty sedate, pretty boring, he wrote some songs, and this happened to be one of them. So we had an opportunity to record something other than a cover, which was important then and as it is now.
Had you been performing this song live?
Up till that time, just maybe to get some familiarity, but we hadn't spent a lot of time with it.
Also, Mark went to Mankato State with Tommy and I also, and started fooling around with some of the Birds songs, and Mark was trying to pick up. And so if you listen to Nowhere to Run, there's a lot of that Birds influence in there with the chord changes and that sort of thing. And then when we did record it, Dick, because it was on a Sunday and we weren't working, Dick Schreier, because he was our roommate, he came over to the recording session too. So the high harmony on the on Nowhere to Run is Dick Schreier. So it's Tommy Cafferty and I and Dick Schreier doing the vocals. And it worked out pretty well.
So this is before Tom went into the Army?
Yes. Shortly thereafter, Tom, because he'd lost his deferment, he didn't do well fall quarter at the U. So he'd lost his deferment and he joined the Army.
And who's doing the lead vocals and background vocals?
The lead is pretty much Tommy and I both. I think at the harmony throughout, and then in the refrain, Dick comes in, Dick Schreier comes in with the high harmony.
Okay. How long were you in the studio?
Boy, I don't remember. I think it was a pretty long day because Timothy D. Kerr had a song he wanted us to do, which we did, and Billy Strandloff played on that.
What'd Bill play?
Bill played it's not the harpsichord, it's the auto harp. Billy, and Bill had the longest hair of anybody I'd ever seen at that time. And he was a friend, a very good friend of Timothy's. And he played this multi-stringed instrument. And it was really a fun session. We really had a good time. And
Do you recall the name of the song?
Tim's song was, I think it was called, Could I Please Buy Some Roses Today? And it had multiple harmonies, and Strandloff sang, Schreier sang, Tommy and I sang. Tim tried to get it on a major label, and it didn't work out, so we ended up releasing Nowhere to Run, and we didn't have anything else recorded, so we put the instrumental on one side and the vocal on the other and ran with it.
So the B-side is strictly the instrumental version of the song with no vocals?
Yes.
Okay.
But Nowhere to Run was supposed to be the B-side of Tim's song that was going to be the A-side.
Okay. And Tim did not want that song released for what reason?
Well, as an artist, as a songwriter, that first release, those rights would contain a lot of the value. And any subsequent release, of course, would just be a cover. And so I think in his mind, he thought this song was valuable and he wanted to have that song with the right artist, although he thought because of our harmonies, we were the right artist, but it did not bring the national attention that he thought it was going to.
Do you know who the songwriter was on
No idea.
Song?
No idea who wrote the song. I don't think Timothy wrote it.
Now, is David Anthony paying for the recording session?
No, I don't think Dave came up with the bucks for that. I think we paid Dove ourselves. And, we were actually a kind of a business operation. You know, we had a checkbook, and a balance. And Hugh's dad was a banker in Minneapolis, so he kind of set us up on the right track right from the beginning.
Do you know how many hours you were in the studio, roughly?
I would guess 6-8 hours.
Now, this is your very first time in a recording studio.
Correct.
Were you nervous?
Well, what I can remember about it is, like, the first take we did, I thought we just nailed it. And he didn't even have the tape running.
The engineer?
The engineer didn't have the tape running. He just wanted to get the levels balanced. And then, so every subsequent take after that, I don't think it had the freshness that first take had.
And you're doing overdubs? Did you do the instrumentals first and then the vocals? Overdubbed?
I think we did the instrumentals first and then overdubbed the vocals.
Yep.
So probably, I'm guessing, was a 4-track machine?
I think Dub may have had an 8-track machine.
8-track, possibly?
Yep.
So the record, I've Got Nowhere to Run, comes out on Peak Records, which was a subsidiary of Metro Beat. And what happens with the record?
I think we sold quite a few for a small operation and just released locally. We got a little local airtime.
On what stations?
I think KDWB and WDGY played it, not extensively. We sold a few off the stage. I think the original printing was backwards, so the side that said instrumental was actually the vocal.
Really?
So we got, say it was a 3,000 printing. We got 3,000 for free because they'd screwed up the labels. So we had a whole bunch laying around for a while. We were giving them away as buck. I subsequently got into the family business of the bar in the bowling alley, and I remember giving away boxes of 25 to people if they showed any interest in Nowhere to Run. I'd say, well, here you go. You can have 25 of them, because we had thousands of them left over.
So did they fix the mistake and do a repressing?
Yes, yes. So then we got the 3,000 that we could sell.
But there were pockets where, like Appleton, for instance, where it got a lot more airplay. Appleton, Wisconsin went over there and played. And that picture of us standing in front of the hearse was from a newspaper writer in Appleton. Then we were just outside Appleton, and it was a hot day, and they took a picture of us, and that it just hung in the files forever.
Did you ever see it on the KDWB or WDGY Top 40 charts that they printed up?
I don't remember seeing it.
Do you recall ever driving around and hearing it on the radio?
I heard it on the radio. In fact, recently Joe Souchray played it on 1500 about 2 months ago.
On his talk radio show?
Yes, yes. And Souchray was in a band called the Bananas, I believe.
Jigs Lee?
Well, I think we played together out at Wakuda Arena in South St. Paul.
So did you take the record around to these radio stations?
I think some... Tim, no. I don't know if Tim would have.
Was Doc Lee promoting it?
I don't know that Doc was around that much then. I think somebody was trying to hustle it for us, but I don't remember who. Would it have been Anthony or the guy that worked for Dave?
Yeah, Bruce Brancic.
Bruce
Brancic, yeah. That would be the name that would come to mind that would probably be a lot more of the promotion or have time to do that.
So your record comes out then in early 67, and you continue to play on your normal schedule?
Yeah, we were pretty heavy into the college circuit then, and a lot of Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin, Mount Telemark. Every Christmas vacation we would work for the whole week or possibly 2 weeks up at Telemark and Hayward.
That's a ski lodge?
Yes, yes. And Tony Wise was the owner then. Everything in Hayward was Wise Construction and Wise Realty, and Tony owned the old Hayward, which was in Hayward itself, was the old lumber camp that he'd put together. And we'd stay at the Clark House. He gave us a room that had two double beds side by side and a bare light bulb in the middle and some nails in the wall. That was the closet. And he had a shared bathroom at the end of the hall. And he always had, remember the Franz Jackson original all-star jazz band from Chicago played at the depot. It was this old train depot that Tony'd moved onto the site. They played at night, and he was, Mr. Wise was very, very conscious of entertainment. And he had entertainment going everywhere. He'd play in Hayward at night or in the afternoon and go up to the Telemark Lodge and the vice versa, I think. Play at Telemark in the afternoon and then Hayward at night and back and forth and back and forth. And he always had really good music down in Hayward.
So with Dick in the band in 1967, was there any change in the music the band is playing?
Well, Dick coming from the big horn band, the Marauders, and then he was with the Heat Twos for a little while, and the Bear Brothers, and he did a lot of the harmonies. But Dick with the Marauders did a lot more soul music. And Dick could carry, you know, he could pull that off in a heartbeat. We did a lot of Little Anthony and the Imperials stuff. But it was all because of Dick. I mean, that I could never sing any of those songs, but Dick certainly could. And then we got heavier and heavier into Bird's songs because of the high harmony. You know, the David Crosby parts in the Bird songs were... Tommy and I were both baritones at best, and adding a tenor really increased the number of songs that we could do a decent job on. And Dick was... Dick was an exceptional musician, singer, guitar player, and the cystic fibrosis caught him. He lived longer than most people at that time lived with cystic fibrosis, but he died right around his 40th birthday at the U of M.
But we could cover songs like 5 o'clock World, and I imagine there's three octaves there that... the lead singer would have to hit, and he could nail it every night. And there are people that still remember us doing that song.
Were there any other songs the band was known for in particular?
Well, there certainly is. We had a moving target there. We didn't have a lot of time to. Practice since we were playing 2, 3, 4 nights a week, but yet we could, Chris and Dick could assemble the harmonies and then try to get the bass part to me or what the chord changes were or whatever, and then Roy would just fill in. So we could throw together a tune pretty quickly with a minimal amount of practice, which was surprising. You know, when you kind of start playing together a lot and play often, people start really listening to each other, and really seems to work very, very well.
At that time, a lot of the soul stuff was really coming on strong, and Motown was coming on, and we weren't, you know, we didn't have horns. We didn't have that big band sound. And for some reason, Dick and I and Hugh and even Tommy just fell in love with the Birds. So I think we were one of the few bands in the Twin Cities area that did Bird songs, and you'd go out in the middle of Wisconsin somewhere, and a lot of these people thought they were original songs because they'd never heard of the Birds. And we did an awful lot of Bird stuff, a lot of that close harmony stuff, and even more when Dick came on board.
So did you or Dick ever have a 12-string guitar?
Oh, yeah. We even had a 12-string when Tommy was in the band. Because I remember we were opened up for Peter and Gordon in Duluth. And we opened with Feel a Whole Lot Better.
And who played the 12-string?
Tommy had the 12-string. We had a 12-string Guild. That was when Jimmy had us all playing Guild guitars. And then when Tom left, the band had purchased the 12-string. So Dick just started playing the Guild 12-string then after Tommy left.
Initially, we had a Rickenbacker 12-string, which, of course, is McGuinn's iconic guitar, and then from B-sharp, and then Jimmy at B-sharp got the guild dealership, and then of course he pushed us very hard to use the guild guitars and bass and get rid of the Fenders, and we gladly did. They were nice, very nice guitars.
So in 1968, I understand you had a change in drummers. Is that correct?
Roy, who had been practicing and playing drums since fifth grade, and at that time, as you remember, the drum sets, drum kits, were not mic'd extensively like they are now. And so basically his rhythm, all his beats and cymbals were all what he could generate physically. You know, to overpower the dual Showmans, the twin reverbs, it took probably a toll on his body. Being a University of Minnesota student, he had free medical service, so he goes and talks to a resident, not a real doctor, but a resident, about his, you know, lingering back pain and leg pain. And this resident said to him, oh, you have to quit drumming. And so without a second opinion and with very little knowledge or forewarning, he said, oh, I got to leave the band. I have to quit drumming. So that put us into a kind of a difficult situation. But fortunately, again, as we had replaced Tommy with Dick, we found Danny Munson to replace Roy.
Was Dan playing in a band at that time?
I think Dan had fooled him around on and off with Dudley and the Do-Rights. I know it was one of the bands that he played with. And I'm not sure if Dave Anthony had something to do with him coming to play with us, but I, as I look back on it, the transition was... It was like Roy was playing one night and Danny was there the next night. Munson was just a phenomenal drummer. God, he was a phenomenal drummer. And I don't think he had any professional training. I think he just had the fastest hands of anybody I'd ever seen. And I don't know that because it was during the school year, I don't think we had a whole lot of rehearsal time. We just went out and did gigs. And Danny just fit right in.
Do you see a change in the musical styles during this time period with the origin of the underground bands that come out, the Doors and bands like that?
We didn't. I don't remember even being interested in the Doors at all.
You stuck to the top 40 songs?
Well, we weren't doing that much top 40 even. We were doing a lot of harmony things. We were fooling around with some Dylan songs because the Birds had taken some Dylan songs. And then when Dick came on, it was like the 5 o'clock Worlds, and we did Walk Away Renee and some of those songs.
Heavy on the vocal harmonies?
Right.
I mean, that's a trend that just runs through the whole time we played, is we relied on vocals, because a lot of bands did not or could not rely on vocals, so that would set us apart, just as the Hearse did, and as the Uniforms or Costumes did, and so we had to make our way.
And Hugh, did you start doing backup vocals at some point?
Right, I did. It's a pretty imposing company to, you know, try to stand up with those guys. I did whatever I could. And, you know, there's some places there's three-part harmonies, some places there's two, and I did whatever I could. And a lot of times I would, while those guys were taking a sip of pop or water, I would announce the next song or whatever, just to give their vocal cords a minute break or whatever. So just try to keep the ball rolling, try to keep people on the dance floor, try to keep the show going.
So it's 1968. You guys are playing now in your fourth year, and things are probably looking pretty good. Did you think it would ever end?
I don't know that we ever thought from the beginning that it was going to last as long as it did. Dick was a year older than the rest of us, and he was finishing at the U of M and looking for graduate school, and got accepted out of Xavier University in Cincinnati, Ohio. That was kind of the writing on the wall, that Hugh and I were both seniors. it was starting to make studying a little more difficult because we were working an awful lot. And the thought of trying to replace Dick, it was one thing replacing the high school buddy, the best friend in Tommy. But I'd lived with Dick for almost 2 years at the U before he came on with us. And that was pretty much like family still. And I don't think I felt there was any more room in my family. I think when Dick left, that was going to be it for me.
Plus, we're now senior year in college, and we probably are going to go different ways or whatever. And at that time, without a national or a regional record or recording contract, at least the next place for us to go was not continue with the ballrooms, but probably into the bars. Although many musicians that we know went that way, including Dick, at the time we just thought that was not the place that we wanted to go.
The other thing hanging over our heads was Vietnam. I'd transferred from Mankato and lost 15 credits. So the draft board was after me. They wanted to keep in touch, and we had played numerous times at the Stillwater Armory, and knew the first sergeant, paid for probably, we did everything 50-50 of the gate, and they had paid for all of their air conditioning and anything for their enlisted man's club. And he called one day and said, you know, I've got this waiting list, but if you and Kramer want to get in the guard, you can come down now and do it. And that was, I think my enlistment date was December of 68. And Dick, our last job with Dick before he left for graduate school was August 23rd of 68. So we had September and October to think about, and he said, get down here. And that's when the two of us joined the National Guard as well.
So your last concert was recorded, I understand.
That's yes, right. We had Dick Larson from the Marauders, and we were good friends with the Marauders all through all those University of Minnesota years. Lars had a 7-inch reel-to-reel tape, and he had one of those little 4-inch microphones that come with that. He had that sitting in front of one of the dual showmans up on the stage, and he recorded our last dance. And it was pretty rough, as you can imagine. There was some problems with that little mic. And I had a guy that was interested in recording over at where I was, after I sold the bowling alley, I was working over in Woodbury. This guy had a little mini studio, and he said he could clean it up a bit. And then another guy that ended up working for me in Woodbury had a big computer system that I'm sure you understand more than I do, but he could run the little cassette tape through it and put it on CD and clean it up and take out bad notes, he could take out all kinds of things, and he cleaned it up as best he could for a tape that was off of a cassette tape. And that was we just gave those away. I had a couple hundred printed, I think, and gave them away. That way we didn't have to list the authors of the songs and pay any royalties. As long as we gave them to people for free, we didn't have to worry about royalties. So,
did you advertise that job as your last performance?
Yes.
We did.
How many people showed up?
It was packed. I imagine 500 would fill the armory, and it was full.
There was as many as the fire marshal would let in. So if somebody left, then they'd let some more in.
That it was not unusual. I have a letter from the Kaufman Union, from the director there, to Doc Lee, and it said how much they appreciated us being there, and we were gentlemanly about it. And they said, in this letter, they said, and as you know, we had to stop admission or letting people in at 1,000. Because that was the capacity of Kaufman Union. So that's that says something about those University of Minnesota years and trying to establish a fan base and with these college kids that and high school kids, obviously, that we worked on.
So you play your final job. Was that a difficult job to play emotionally?
I think for me, it hit me that, you know, we weren't going to play anymore, but this was a conscious decision that we were going to try to go out on top, that we weren't just going to find another lead guitar player and then just kind of go on into oblivion and start playing bars and all that, that we had taken this really much farther than we thought we could have. And why not have a fresh memory in your mind? We had some money in the bank. We had this brand new, well, at that time it was a year old, 67 Ford station wagon. And we had some money, and we, the three of us, obviously Dick went on to school, but Chris and I and Roy jumped in that car and just drove around the country till all the money was gone.
So it was a positive ending.
Very positive. Very positive.
Yes, yes it was.
For you too,
and
Chris?
The thing, I think, that the amazing thing for me was that the morticians paid for my college education. I went to Mankato State for a year. And 4 years at the U, because I got a little interrupted with the National Guard basic training. But that was my only source of income. My folks didn't help. I didn't get a dime from my mother and dad. So rock and roll paid for 5 years of college. And I think the equivalent, you know, the equivalent of that be today. It's it was cheaper then, but it paid for that. I met my wife through the morticians. She went to Hamlin with Hugh. A Stillwater girl that I'd never spoken to until met her at a dance, and we've been married for 44 years. So the morticians was good for me. It was a college education, a wife, wonderful daughter, two grandkids that I left to come over here today.
So, but we ran it like a business, and there was a lot of bands that got all full of themselves and got all caught up in it. We would never... we wouldn't have these groupies, these girlfriends coming to the dance. But that's not to say that we didn't bring any young ladies home. I'm not saying that. But we kept it to us. We kept it to the business of getting there, getting on time, getting set up, getting tuned up, and starting on time or as close to on time as we possibly could. And I think that spoke well as far as return engagements to a lot of these other ballrooms that probably had, you know, some late shows or no shows, and maybe due to their events of breakdown in equipment or whatever, but we seemed to always make it there. And my parents paid my way through college, but for the rest of the guys, you know, that's a nice way to do that. And for instance, like that station wagon that we bought was less than $3,000, but we were making anywhere from $150 to $300 a night. So we could have that vehicle paid for in not too many nights of playing. So compared to $2013, it was like we were getting paid $1,500 to $3,000 a night, if you, you know, compare price of vehicles, etc.